I'm Dr. Sarah, a licensed chiropractor.
And I'm Val, clinical research enthusiast and international board-certified lactation consultant.
We are passionate about helping you navigate women's health and wellness topics naturally.
We bring the information and options
so you can make empowered choices.
This is the Empowered Women podcast. Just a reminder, the information contained in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease or illness or be taken as medical advice. Always check with your healthcare provider for medical advice.
Well, I think we should start off by saying that—
Are you recording?
Yes, I'm already
recording. Oh, I was like, wait, are we recording before I say anything, like, totally?
No. So we took a break. Both of us really needed a mental break.
Yes, we apologize. We apologize. Were on vacation. Both of us were on vacation, and then the kids had spring break, and now we're back.
We're back, and it's late at night because ask me how I've been. I've been holding a baby for 3 days.
Yeah.
Rotavirus, for sure. No doubt in my mind. The sickest he has ever been. Sad. Which is why I wanted to talk about this topic today, because the whole time, not that I could be, but I was like, man, right. If I was breastfeeding.
It makes it easier. I know, it's hard.
I mean, he only really wants to hang out with me again, which is like cool because, you know, I missed that.
I know.
Like selfishly. But a part of me was like, oh my God, like if I was nursing, he would just be getting everything that he needed. But then again, I'm pregnant, so would I still be nursing? Probably not, maybe.
You never know. I know. You just
don't know. You don't know.
Yeah, I know. It's like, which is a good question. Can people nurse while they're pregnant?
Let's talk about it. Can you?
So we were like going back and forth with topics for today, and then you had suggested common nursing questions.
Yeah, right? This is a big one.
This is a very big one. And I want to say that this is very misunderstood, particularly in the medical community.
Perfect.
Particularly amongst medical professionals. I apologize, I just got interrupted.
Okay.
But we're going to be very quiet because they know I'm recording. It's like, it's actually looked, I feel like it's looked down upon. I don't want to say looked down upon. It is just not really widely accepted.
Okay.
And parents get told a lot of different things. Parents get told, I think, incorrect information a lot of the time. They're told it's dangerous to breastfeed while they're pregnant, or they could be, you know, endangering their unborn child. They say you shouldn't be like tandem nursing, which is a whole different thing. So for people that don't know what that is when somebody is breastfeeding. A lot of times they have breastfed through a pregnancy. They have a subsequent baby and now they're nursing the first child and the new baby.
Okay. So many questions already. Why would someone say it was dangerous?
I think the misconception is that you're taking
nutrients.
Yes, nourishment away from the growing baby/fetus. It's your body is always going to protect the baby. Like that's the first priority,
right?
Biologically, right? Like that's just a given. Like even if mom has, say, an eating disorder and they're starving themselves, the nutrients are going to go to the baby first, and she's going to get like. There's no competition biologically. The unborn child is getting all the, you know.
You're right.
Right. So a lot of times what happens is when you're breastfeeding and you become pregnant, sometimes your milk can dry up due to the change in hormones that occurs. Okay. Sometimes there's a dip in supply. A lot of times the milk will start to taste different to the child that is breastfeeding, and they may or may not continue nursing.
Okay.
They either don't like it, they can't get enough milk and they stop, or they're old enough to voice their concerns and opinions and tell you what's going on. A lot of the times they just don't care and they continue to nurse, or they'll dry nurse. Some moms will dry nurse through that period where their milk dries up and then it comes back.
Hmm.
So the mother may not even know that they're not making milk for a little bit of time or a period of time. And the toddler, or, you know, the baby infant that they already have, continues to nurse. And there's no, you know, nobody would know any different.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, I mean, this happens all the time, but I had a patient who had a baby July 10th, and then the next July 10th, baby's first birthday, she had her second baby.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's people that are get pregnant before their child's a year. Now, baby's primary source of nutrition the first year of life is either formula or breast milk. So if you're breastfeeding, you have to be, you just have to keep an eye on their, you know, their weight gain. Obviously, a lot of times nature just works the way it's supposed to, and it's not an issue. Like,
second, third world country, you don't have the luxury of just going to the store. You become pregnant, but you still need to nurse your baby. You nurse your baby.
You can. So the short answer is, and the correct answer is, yes, it's safe to breastfeed through a pregnancy. It is absolutely 100% safe and acceptable, especially, you'd be surprised here in our country how often it happens, to tandem nurse. So to nurse a newborn or an infant with an older child, there's no concern there. You always nurse the newborn. I mean, you nurse the younger baby first to ensure, you know, that they're getting what they need, because obviously the older child can consume food or other things.
Right.
And then you allow the other child to nurse, or you let them both nurse. It's really up to the mother, you know, her, like, what works for her. Sometimes they nurse them both at the same time.
So, I mean, like, your body is just essentially thinking that you had twins instead of.
Yeah, you're, yes. At that, so when you get pregnant, like I said, the composition changes, you could actually lose your milk, and then it starts to come back again as you start making colostrum for the next baby in the end of this of that subsequent pregnancy. And then, of course, you'll have colostrum. So a lot of times the older children will know that, and they'll say the milk has changed, or it's funny, or it's not the same. And then they know that that mature milk is coming. So then you have your transition to what we call mature milk, or, you know, actual breast milk as we know it. So it does, your body does cycle through all of the phases that it needs to of lactation. But the older child doesn't really seem to mind usually.
So since you didn't get probably Matt, I mean, older children don't give a fuck.
No, and then, like, a lot of people say their other one, their older child stopped nursing because their milk dried up. And a lot of times it's very uncomfortable to nurse, especially the first try. It's very painful.
I know that.
It's, your nipples are very sensitive, like, that first trimester, and it hurts to nurse another child. So it's, a lot of times mom either wants to or needs to stop, or, like I said, the baby or child knows, like, there's just no milk, and they're like, hey, I don't want this anymore. There's nothing there. There's also something called nursing aversion. And I mean, when you're breastfeeding, you can experience this many different times, depending on how long you nurse, you know, different, just how you're feeling about things in general. But a lot of times moms will experience nursing aversion when they're pregnant and they're breastfeeding another child. And it's like really strong. It's just feelings of not wanting to nurse. It's really having like an aversion to breastfeeding or being touched, or, you know, just the whole concept of, like, and I, like, sometimes I wonder, there's no research to back this, but if that's nature's way of saying, like, hey, you know, your body,
I can't do this right now.
Maybe you don't want to do this right now. Maybe you just have to take a break for a little bit, you know, while these hormones are fluctuating. It's interesting to me, because as women, we push through a lot. And we continue and we want to do what's best for our children. And if our milk isn't really drying up or they're not saying it's drying up, then we really see no need to try to wean them. Because quite frankly, for anybody listening who has never tried to wean a child that has not weaned themselves, it is not an enjoyable experience. It's very challenging for the parent and the child. It's emotionally difficult. So a lot of times I think as mothers, we're just like, okay, well, I'm just going to push through this, even though I feel like I don't want to do it. And I'm having like a total aversion to this. I'm repulsed by it, but we're going to keep going. And then it goes away.
Yeah, I would say that Eli pretty much weaned himself.
A lot of babies do.
And it was earlier than I thought I wanted, but I was also having like a lot of gut health issues. So
I remember it was
mutually exclusive at that point. But there are still moments, especially, you know, when he preferred Mike, that I was like, I wish that we still nursed, because then like he would want me at that point. But again, like those are my selfish
moments. I know. They're feelings. Yeah. Oh, and they're totally valid. But you're going to get to do it all over again.
I know. I'm like, oh my gosh, how's that going to be?
Probably totally different than the first time.
Oh, I'm hoping. So you had mentioned colostrum.
Uh-huh.
For those that don't know what colostrum is and its benefits, can we talk about that? Because
So
I also thought about that this weekend. I was like, man, I wish I had some colostrum.
I know. And it's funny because there's a distinct, so when you have your baby, whether you have a C-section or a vaginal birth, there's a dramatic shift in your hormones. So once you birth the placenta, your body's like, oh, there's this huge drop in progesterone. So progesterone actually inhibits prolactin, which is your milk-making hormone. Prolactin is the milk-making hormone. So the high amounts of progesterone inhibit prolactin so that you don't make milk while you're pregnant. Like, you know, full mm-hmm. on, yes, women will leak. You can harvest colostrum before you have a baby. I'm not saying it's not there. It is. But the lactogenesis that needs to occur after the placenta is birthed and that drop in progesterone occurs, that's not the milk you're going to be having before the baby's born. It's nothing near that. Mm-hmm. So that happens. Prolactin rises and then it starts telling your body to make milk. So the initial stages of lactation are, it's actually an endocrine process. So that's why like hormones are so critical and important and the balance of them. And a lot of times when people are having milk supply issues, we ask a lot about your hormones, you know, check insulin levels, you know, blood sugar levels. You want to make sure there was no retained placenta because that can inhibit the, like all these kinds of things. So it's actually an endocrine process initially, and then it switches to an autocrine control, which is like a local control at the breast level after that transition to mature milk occurs. So initially what happens is, like I said, we have that drop in progesterone, we have the rise in prolactin, and your body starts making what's known as colostrum. Or you've been making it, but now this is what the baby is consuming after mm-hmm. they're born. It's known as liquid gold. And there's like, there's so many reasons for that. So it tends to be very thick, very sticky mm-hmm. for people that colostrum harvest, or maybe when you first start to pump, you're like, oh, I'm not making milk. Like I'm just getting these little bits, which is totally normal, by the way, mm-hmm. Initially. And it's known as like baby's first, well, besides birth through the vaginal canal, because that inoculates the baby's digestive tract and mm-hmm. creates, you know, their part of their immune system as we know it. They're basically getting their first like vaccines through your colostrum. They're getting like immune support, like on steroids. Think of it that way.
Right.
So it's antibodies. It is, you know, all the fat, protein. It's the perfect food that your baby needs, with all of these extra extra things the first couple of days. So you want, I mean, colostrum's super important. So for people who decide ultimately not to breastfeed, a lot of times they'll say, oh, well, I just want to make sure the baby gets the colostrum initially. I mean, and there's a really good reason for that. Everything right. in there seals the gut lining. Breastfeeding itself seals the gut lining, which is why it's recommended, you know, initially for that first year of life. It has a long-term effect on gut health. And a lot of that can also have to do with the immune properties and everything you're getting from mom initially. There's stem cells in there. There are compounds that when they interact with the baby's gut have like anti-tumor properties. It's, I mean, the research on breast milk is insane, but a lot of these components are in colostrum. And the composition of colostrum is different than mature milk that comes in. So it's super fatty, like right. initially. It might not have as much protein. It's like a lot of fat. And then the composition of breast milk changes after that transition from colostrum to mature milk.
So I have two questions mm-hmm. that are probably going to be a little bit longer. But the first is like, professional recommendation. Obviously, you don't know the people that might be listening to this, but if someone had a terrible like latching experience, didn't want to breastfeed, but might understand the benefits of colostrum and want to harvest it, how would they go about doing that then?
So they sell, they being manufacturers.
They. We're always they, talking about they.
I know. I always talk about the powers that be and they. So you can buy colostrum harvesting kits. And a lot of them come with instructions. Obviously, it's something you could look up online. You could talk to a professional. You could talk to a counselor or peer support. Like, really anybody that has experience with breastfeeding. But you buy the colostrum kit and you follow the instructions. So essentially, you are hand expressing or pumping colostrum. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful with pumping in the later weeks because it can trigger labor. So a lot of times colostrum harvesting isn't done with pumping, but you would collect it in a small container. And then there's little vials where you're basically, you know, extracting the colostrum and storing them in. Like, I think the maximum stomach capacity of a baby is like half a tablespoon on the first day. Okay. You know, they're getting like 5 to 7 mL. Like, it's like so little. That's why they're feeding so frequently. So those little colostrum containers are tiny. And you suck up the colostrum. Sometimes they're syringes. Sometimes they look a little different. Like, they're just these little pre-filled tubes that you can cap. And you can store them in the freezer until you have your baby. And then you could just administer the milk to the baby if you wanted to provide them with colostrum, but maybe you're not going to latch your baby or you're not going to like breastfeed.
So, that was part of my second question was like, how much harvesting should somebody do if they're preparing for that?
I mean, that's
or how early?
So, it depends. I think I've read like 33, 34 weeks. A lot of times.
So like, early.
Yeah, 37 weeks. Like you can, I mean, you don't have to start it like that early. It depends on if you're seeing colostrum. I mean, some right. people don't even know that they can harvest or that there's anything.
I didn't. Yeah. I didn't. And I like definitely had signs of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what it was, but I didn't know that I could harvest it.
Some women leak even earlier in their pregnancy, like their breasts leak, and they're totally freaked out. But that's normal, too.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but, like, I noticed, like, the yellow,
mm-hmm.
like, crust.
Yeah.
And so, like, I knew what it was, but I think a lot of people would just assume that it was something, like,
like a discharge or something.
Yeah.
Which it, I mean, it could look it like is, that. But yeah, it's, I mean, there, it's really up to you and how much you want to store and how much you want to collect. Usually people just do like a day or two's, you know, worth of feeding, which is just a couple of tubes. You know, it doesn't have to be this like insane process.
So if you're harvesting colostrum, does it decrease the amount when baby's born?
No.
That's cool. No.
So, I mean, your your body is always making milk if you are breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. Even the first, as soon as you have the baby, like even those first couple of days when you're still in under endocrine control, and then before it switches to, you know, localized autocrine control. So that's a question we get a lot is, you know, is there milk there? You know, don't you have to supplement, like colostrum? That's not enough. You know, my baby's not getting enough. My milk hasn't come in. Like, no. Your body is making exactly what it needs to for the baby, unless there's something, you know, strikingly wrong, like right away.
Right.
You know, like obviously in the hospital, like maybe like diaper output the first day or two is not normal. Baby's not getting enough, you know, or something along those lines, like a professional notices something, you know, that's not right, or you think something's not right. But a lot of times people assume that they're not making what they need to for their baby, which is not correct.
So explain, and you know what's so funny is that did you remember the show Jane the Virgin?
Yeah, I never watched it, but I know what you're talking about.
So the episode that she actually has the baby, she like doesn't understand why the baby's crying all the time, the baby's nursing all the time, blah blah blah. And like it's like immediately after birth, and the dad was reading all these books and he said the baby's just cluster feeding and trying to get your milk supply up.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that. So if a provider tells you that you're not making enough milk because that's why the baby's cluster feeding, you should do formula. Like, what would your response be to that?
So there's actually a lot of the American Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine or has protocols relate it to supplementation, and they're actually pretty conservative. Like, supplementation should not be started unless there is a medical necessity, or again, there is something blatantly wrong that the medical staff, you know, has identified. Other than that, baby should not, you know, be supplemented with anything other than mother's own milk if that's what they want, unless it's been deemed appropriate or necessary. Not just because somebody thinks like they're not getting enough, because it's hard to determine that initially. It really mm-hmm. is hard to determine that the first couple of days, unless we do a weighted feed and there's like absolutely no transfer, or right. the diaper output is so glaringly problematic, or the weight loss is just, you know, 10% right. or more, and it's just not coming back up. I mean, then we're like, really, okay, like we need to start like figuring out what's going on here. But you're making what you need with colostrum. Your baby can survive on colostrum alone until your milk comes in. What does that mean? That means that they are going to feed very frequently because their stomach is only the size of a cherry. It is so tiny.
Oh, like so small.
And that means that your baby needs very frequent feedings. The other thing is breast milk goes through the digestive tract very quickly. It's designed that way. It's magic. It's supposed to be that way. It's not like formula. It doesn't hang around. It doesn't keep baby full as long, usually. What does that mean? That means you're going to need to be nursing a lot. Babies are nursing a ton the first couple days until your milk comes in for both of those reasons, and also because frequent nursing is causing your milk to transition
mm-hmm.
to mature milk. I don't like to say come in because it's been there. So there's like a lot of yeah. people don't like to use that term, but transition to a full milk supply, you know, with the milk that you need as mature milk. They're going to nurse a lot. And a lot of times what you find is maybe like the first day or two, baby's kind of sleepy and like they're pretty content and they nurse, and maybe they like have a long sleep one time, or they're not as fussy, or you need to put them to the breast like every 2 hours because they're just not really looking for it. But then all of a sudden they get like psycho and they are nursing and nursing and nursing, and they're literally nursing like 24/7. And then your milk usually comes in the day after that. They're telling your body, like, we got to get this going. Where is it? Like, me being on here, it's bringing it in. Like, this is what we need. There's usually a night where the baby's up, like, all night. And parents get so worried. They call it second night syndrome because a lot of times it's, like, the first night you're home from the hospital. If you had a hospital birth, sometimes it's the second night after your home birth. It could be later than that, you know, if it's taking your milk a little bit longer to come in. Everybody's milk comes in at different time points, and there's also a lot of things that affect the transition to mature milk. So when your milk is going to come in, which people don't know either. But first-time moms, it could be as long as 5 to 7 days. Moms that have had a C-section, it can be really long. If you've had IV fluids or Pitocin, everything about your birth is going to affect your breastfeeding experience. And
it matters.
Sorry to be the bringer of bad news. I really am. But if you want to breastfeed, please, for the love of God, do your research and take a really good breastfeeding course or class, because all the decisions you make, like, before and during your birth, even if you don't think they're going to have an effect afterwards, they can significantly impact your breastfeeding experience, especially in the beginning when you don't want it to be, like, uber rocky.
What resources, because you've been in this space for a while, what resources for classes do you recommend to people? Because, I mean, it depends on their experience, but depending on where you go is, yeah, it really makes a difference.
It does make a difference. Like, I think the hospitals, they try to do a good job. Some of them do a better job than others. They're always taught by IBCLCs usually. So they're evidence-based. They're good. I don't feel like breastfeeding classes do enough to prepare people. And I said this in the podcast that I did on this weeks ago. They're great. And I think you need to take one, because a lot of people tell me, like, I don't know anything about breastfeeding when I show up at their house. And I'm like, oh, and they're like, I just know I want to breastfeed, or that it's good for them. And I'm like, whoa, okay, like, that's a commitment, like, for you not, like, knowing much about it, which is amazing. But I think it's important for people to just understand how it works, like, the biological process, like, everything we kind of just talked about, like, your milk, you know, you've got colostrum, you know, when can you possibly expect it to transition? How much should baby be eating? How often? Like, those, any breastfeeding class is probably going to go over all of those basics. I really feel like parents should have a visit with an IBCLC, because it's like your own personalized breastfeeding class, or an LC, or talk to a peer counselor and get all your questions answered, you know, before. And I've said this before, but when you're pregnant, find a breastfeeding support group. Whether it's one online, you can just pop in on the weekends, or, you know, after work if you're working, or if you can get to one in person. One, there's going to be tons of people there that can answer your questions, and you're going to hear from other people living it what is normal. Not from what you read online, not from what your pediatrician is telling you, not from what you think you know or is going to happen, because that might not be your reality. Everybody's journey is different.
Well, I second the support group, because for me, I've said this before, I absolutely knew that I only wanted to exclusively breastfeed. And I knew that if I went to certain people in my life, they would have said, it's okay to just do formula. And I just didn't want to. So having that support of people, and my sister-in-law literally just told me last weekend, I wish I would have nursed her first, knowing that she had formula on hand, because it just made her feel like there was a safe place, a safe backup. And she had that with her second, but she successfully, like, fed Gus, like, with no problems.
Right.
For me, it was reaching out to people who I know succeeded.
But struggled. Because it's different.
It is. Like, I didn't want to talk to people that just decided to do away with it.
And it's a mindset.
It's a huge mindset.
It's a mindset situation as well. There's also, it's important to be around people that are nursing, where there's also probably a professional there. It's important to be either interact with a professional if you need help or before you have the baby, because there is a point where, you know, you really need to take your mental health into consideration. So yes, you need to be around people who can give you suggestions, whether that looks like combi feeding or supplementing at times or expressing and giving, you know, feeding a different way mm-hmm. to get through or over maybe a hump or figure out the situation. It's important because some people may drive themselves to, you know, the brink of
crazy. Yeah. I am a shitty night person and I know that about myself. So I would pump at night and mm-hmm. give Eli a bottle.
Yeah. I know a lot of people that do that. And for them, they swear it's easier.
Was easier for like 9 months until Eli was a pro. And then I was like, okay, it's just easier to latch him. Like, why am I going to get all this shit out to latch him?
I know. It just depends on
your mindset changes as it becomes easier. Mm-hmm. That's what I found personally.
Yes. No, I think it's true. I think that's just indicative of
life
experience. Yeah. Of the experience for people. It's not easy. We don't see it. I've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. We're not around it. We're not in groups where we're exposed to it. Those are the only places you can get in groups where you're exposed to it, where people literally, like someone said this to me before, like, that's so weird. People sit around nursing their babies. Well, yeah, because where else in the world can you go to learn to breastfeed?
Nowhere.
Well, other parts of the world.
Yeah. Other parts of the world, but
from each other. But
where in the United States can you go?
Here in modern society, where nobody's doing it really in the open most of the time or supporting it and wanting you to just get a breast pump and go back to work in 6 weeks, because go back to work, it's the capitalist society we're in. You know, we don't see it. We don't learn it. And there was a big period of time where formula marketing is still, it's big bucks, guys. It's big bucks, okay? And their messaging matters and how they message and market matters. And there was a period of time where they came in and they swooped in, you know, and wanted to save all the babies and feed the world, because that's better, you know, than you feeding them. So we didn't see breastfeeding in our society really a lot after that. And a lot of people did use formula for a long time.
Well, I mean, like you go to your OB at the end of your pregnancy, like pretty frequently. And every time I was there, they were giving me formula mm-hmm. every time. And eventually I was like, yeah, go ahead and give it to me. I'm going, it was around the time where we were taking all those refugees in New Jersey and we didn't have ways to feed the babies. So I was like, I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to use this, but I'm going to send this to the base in New Jersey. And then they gave me like 10 of them. But like, there is a time and a place. But
I mean,
the marketing is strong.
The marketing is strong. And you made a point with saying that just now and a little while ago. I'm going to have this formula on hand just in case, mm-hmm. my insurance, because I need insurance, because what if I can't feed my baby with my
body? Yeah, it's already limiting.
It's already in your head. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's not a thing. I mean, as a lactation professional, I am extremely grateful for formula and we're very fortunate to have it in this country most of the time readily available, because we do need it as a tool a lot. But it's already ingrained in us that we're going to fail. Our bodies are going to fail us because, you know what? Be honest, nobody really knows what they're doing initially. That's the problem.
Let's go back to the whole, like, going back to work at 6 weeks. True or false? Because I had heard this before. Pumping, like, when you start to pump, you should really be, like 6 weeks is too early to pump because it can cause more mastitis?
So, if somebody needs to pump for medical reasons or for a true supply issue, or maybe their baby was born as a preemie or they're in the NICU, like there's a lot of reasons why a mom would need to pump before 6 weeks. The recommendation is if your baby is nursing and they're nursing well and they're gaining well, all the indicators are there, diaper output's there, there's no issues, apparent issues, let's say, really it's not recommended to pump before the 4 to 6 week mark because you want your body to regulate your supply itself.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people start pumping early because they want some backup, they want a freezer stash, or, you know, they just want, and that's okay. Like, we all do that for different reasons. There's nothing wrong with having extra milk or a little bit of a stash if you want, or building that up. But a lot of times what ends up happening is you pump yourself into an oversupply, or you can. It doesn't happen to everybody. But I feel like it happens a lot because people just have a pump and they start pumping. Like when they're just like, oh, I have a breast pump and I should start pumping now. Like,
it's like you get it for free. Might as well.
Unless you need a reason to pump, like you're gonna be away from your baby for a feeding or a series of feedings before the 4 to 6 weeks mark. The other thing about the 4 to 6 week mark that's important is we say no introduction of nipples or pacifiers before 4 to 6 weeks, because you want your supply to be robust, to be regulated by the baby. So you don't want to introduce any artificial nipples before that. Now, if you're giving a bottle, you're introducing an artificial nipple. So you wouldn't need to pump unless you were using the bottle. Like, it kind of goes hand in hand. You know, it's like multifaceted.
I feel like my milk supply never regulated with Eli.
I was always consistently
like just pumping the same, but I wonder, like, I want,
like, well, that's normal. I mean, that's not a bad thing. That's normal. Like, you mean every single time you pumped the same amount
from like beginning to end? It like never changed. I swear. Like maybe sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was more, but like never by like a vast amount.
There was no variation. Like, I mean, maybe that is your normal.
Yeah. I mean, he was never like
hungry
or cranky or hungry or anything like that. But my pumping story, breastfeeding story is just.
Yeah, your story
was terrible, but it was beautiful at the end. Terrible.
I'm trying not to laugh. You said terrible.
Terrible for reasons I cannot discuss on air.
Oh, I mean, I know. Like, I have to tell you, like, my
people can message me privately. I will go into full detail.
My heart aches. You know, I work with families a lot, and I see what they go through to feed their babies, and like my heart aches for people. It's like not. Breastfeeding is not an easy thing. It's not usually a super simple journey for mom and baby. It's something that needs to be taught. It's something that has to be learned. And you really do need to make sure that there's not issues. Like, I hate to say that, but like, it's really important to get evaluated to make sure there aren't any issues, because even though it seems like things might be going well or the indicators are there, that doesn't mean breastfeeding is actually going the way it should be, meaning for baby or you. Like, so the, you know, we always get the question, like, how do I know if my baby's getting enough? My baby's not getting enough. You know, they want to eat all the time. Well, the main indicators of baby getting enough or thriving are diaper output and weight gain. That's what professionals look at. That's what we look at. That's what pediatricians look at. That's what everybody wants to see. That doesn't mean breastfeeding is actually going well. That means that baby is gaining weight and that's what they want to see and growing.
Right.
So there's a lot of other things that could be happening or going wrong for mom or for baby. So yeah. Just because someone's like, well, my baby's producing 5 to 6 wet diapers a day, they're pooping every time they eat, and they're like growing so well, but my nipple hurts so bad.
Oh my God.
Or my baby has reflux, or they're crying all the time, or they're gassy, or they're tense, or they're clicking. Well, you know, there are like a million different things that could be happening that are indicators that breastfeeding is not going well.
Right.
Beyond diaper output and weight gain.
Oh yeah. Like Eli's diaper output, weight gain, beautiful.
Yeah. But you had a heck of a time. Yeah.
Like lipstick nipple. I had an abscess for weeks.
I know.
People, like 20 cc's of infected fluid that went undetected.
Mm-hmm.
I did dangle feeding. I will never forget dangle feeding in my living room. And we have like a small window on our front door. And I was like, this is going to be the moment Amazon delivers a package to my front steps.
It's actually, so there's new evidence that suggests that that's actually not helpful at all. So we don't recommend that anymore. FYI, you don't need to dangle feed ever again in your life.
It was wild. If you don't know what dangle feeding is, please just with as much as you can, please just try to explain what dangle feeding is.
So dangle feeding is where
awful.
Okay, so this was used to be recommended. I feel like I said the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine. I might have said American Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine before. I correct myself. But the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine just came out with a new mastitis and clogged duct protocol, which is whoa thorough. I mean, like pages and pages. When I opened this puppy, I was like,
hey,
I need to sit down for this research paper. It was like my head wanted to explode, but it's really good. And they don't really recommend the whole dangle feeding thing anymore. Dangle feeding
don't go in every direction.
Yeah. Dangle feeding was used where you like lean over the baby and literally dangle your breast so that they are nursing, and what you're trying to do is unclog a clogged duct. So the thought was like, if you were dangle feeding, you know, gravity is working, the baby's sucking, they're pulling down, like the clog will come out. And I mean, you're literally like hanging over like a cow and like
all force.
Position. Yeah. I mean, however else you could do it, I don't
know. Boobs just flopping in the wind.
There's some really crazy things that we do to nurse our babies.
Hey, you know what? Didn't have a clogged duct.
I know. Maybe it still works for people. I mean,
if you're at your freaking wit's end.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things like, I don't want to say like old wives' tales. There's a lot of things that people still do. They don't really recommend according to the research or the evidence. You know, it's like, okay, well,
no, maybe my patients bring me bottle of wine because that's what old Italians do. Yeah. I mean,
if it works for you, I'm like, look, if it works for you, whatever. I'm going to tell you what the evidence is.
Yeah, yeah. Also
things that like people do that, hey, like maybe it's not as widely accepted, but it's working.
It's what's there.
Yeah. There was the whole like Hakka salt Epsom or salt water.
I tried that too.
Where it would like pull the clog out, and actually worked really well for a lot of people. So you would fill the Hakka with like saline solution that you make at home, but then they address that like in the protocol, like you're not supposed to do that anymore. They're saying it could like lead to like nipple damage. Like you're not, it's just like not, it's not a scientific thing. Like that's probably the thing I take away from reading the protocol with some of that is that there's just no like research and science to back up some of it. Mm-hmm. And there's things that they have found like with the Hakka saline thing where it actually like was causing damage allegedly.
So when I went to get my abscess drained first time, the breast surgeon was asking me how breastfeeding was going. And I was like, oh, I call my lactation consultant twice a week. I would have used Val, but she was not certified yet. She is now.
Don't ever feel guilty for using somebody else. I'll never hold it against you.
She was great. She came to my house like a dozen times. That's not exaggerating, because she just wanted me to succeed. And that is the sign of a good lactation consultant. The breast surgeon told me, well, first, what did she say? That I should scar my nipple so that it didn't hurt so bad. As in, like, use saline solution so that they would, like, essentially
damage scar your nipple so you can't feel.
Mm-hmm.
But see, the issue with that is, okay,
so how can that affect the nipple itself?
Well, the problem is, like, the nerves, your body is sensing the baby sucking.
Yeah. So
there's this efferent arc that they talk about. The sucking, this is when it goes to localized control. So it's the baby removing the milk that is causing your body to make more milk. But it's really important for you to be able to feel in your nipples, because the sucking motion is actually what triggers that milk ejection reflex. You don't want your nipples to be toughened up or scarred. You don't want nipple damage or nipple trauma or decreased nipple sensitivity. Nipple sensitivity is important. Like, the nerve endings are important in this mm-hmm. whole process. You sensing the baby sucking is huge to breastfeeding being successful.
Well, like, I took the advice because I was at my wit's end. And yeah. then, like, I had, like, no nipple sensitivity for, like, a significant amount of time, even after nursing Eli. And I was like, what the hell did I just do to myself?
Yeah. This is why when women have breast surgery, whether mm-hmm. it was for a reduction or implants or to remove some type of mass or whatever, if they're going to breastfeed or they're going to have children later and they're not sure if they want to breastfeed, it's really important that they find someone that knows what they're doing and they research a way to minimally affect the nipple areola complex and the nerves that are innervating that area.
Mm-hmm.
Because guys, the anatomy is complex and there's a lot going on and there's a lot of things that need to be working properly. And oftentimes a breast surgery, depending on what it is, can significantly impact that.
I'm just thinking, I want to look something up real quick.
No, you're fine. I have other questions too that are common. I was thinking.
See, okay. So sometimes whenever a pregnant mom comes in, we talk a lot about like pre and postnatal care.
Mm-hmm.
So nipple nerve intervention or innervation comes from like thoracic spine. Intercostal mm-hmm. regions.
I was going to say the intercostal, is it the seventh? I don't know. One of them is like incredibly important that innervates the breast there. I want to say it's like the seventh intercostal nerve or something.
Well, it's like, I always talk about breastfeeding, positioning. I adjust shoulders, elbows, hands, wrists, because like you're doing a lot with your upper extremities that you haven't done before. So always check that. But like the mid thoracics is where people need it the most. And what do the thoracics articulate with? The intercostal region. So getting adjusted I wonder how much that affects some of those reflexes.
Right. Right. I mean, anytime there's interference, we've talked about this before, there's going to be decreased function.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I don't, you know, that can have an effect on it. I mean, that is not an evidence-based reason for, you know, primary lactation failure. You know, there's all different there's all different points of what we like causes for, you know, insufficient.
It can't hurt.
Yeah. So that is not one that we would, you know, think of where that's well researched. A lot of it has to do with glandular testosterone, hormones and surgeries. And mm-hmm. but I'm curious, like, how much of an effect that would have on, you know, breastfeeding success you know, supply, not necessarily supply. I mean, maybe milk ejection reflex.
That's what I'm thinking, like, yeah, more specifically. That'd be interesting. I mean,
there are people that struggle with milk ejection reflex. So, like, you know, sometimes they struggle to have a letdown. You know, a lot of things can affect your letdown, like your stress level, your anxiety level, fear, pain. Mm-hmm. When you're having breastfeeding pain or you're having nipple pain and the baby's latching and they're screaming and you're stressed and uncomfortable, do you really think your milk's just going to like come on down and start flowing? No, your baby's going to probably have to suck like they've never sucked before to get it out. Like, and it's not going to be good for either one of you.
I used to sit there with a towel and bite down on a tile.
Oh, Sarah.
Towel in order for Eli to latch. Like, it was a whole process. Like, put the boppy on, get Eli, undo the nursing bra, and then Mike would bring me a towel and I would bite down and then we would latch Eli.
So,
like, it was a whole freaking thing. But it was stress. No wonder, like, it was...
It's stressful.
Horrible.
And that's why sometimes when people start pumping or they're away from their baby or they have to go back to work, like, they really struggle mm-hmm. with output. There's a lot of reasons why supply can shift then, but we always say, like, you need to, like, try to relax, look at pictures of your baby, smell something of the baby's. Like, mm-hmm. just, like, try to get calm, let the oxytocin flow. Like, you want to have as many milk ejection reflexes as you can, you know, during that pumping session. And anything that can relax you or not stress you out, which is hard this day and age, you know, then the milk can flow.
It's that's like energy.
What did you say?
It's like energy. It's like a river.
It's like your key. Let's just get it flowing. That's another really good one. Is it supposed to hurt? So that is a really, that's a common question. It's a good question because pain and perceived low milk supply are the two main reasons that people stop breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. So is it supposed to hurt? I think there's a common misconception that it's not supposed to be uncomfortable. I'm not saying it should be uncomfortable, but your body goes through a hormonal shift. And the first, like, week or two, it's normal to have a lot of sensitivity in your nipples, which could be described as uncomfortable. That is not pain.
Right.
Or nipple trauma or mm-hmm. nipple damage or cracked or bleeding nipples. This is totally different. Like, somebody sucking on your nipples a lot of times a day is going to cause sensitivity, sometimes some irritation, you know, some chafing, possibly they're going to be sensitive from the hormonal changes. Like, it could be a little uncomfortable. It's not going to be unbearable. It shouldn't right. be like this. Like, you shouldn't have to bite down on a towel like yourself.
Right.
But
or have chunks missing out of your nipple.
Yeah. I mean, some of the nipple, like some of the, yeah.
Nipple trauma?
Yes. The damage and the, yes, it's just, it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't hurt, be painful. Some people say beyond the initial latch. Sometimes people have some discomfort with the initial latch that goes away, like, right away.
Mm-hmm.
And then that shifts to not be anything, you know, within like a week or two. That's common. That can be normal. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be evaluated. If you're having any type of discomfort, it needs to get checked out because you want to make sure it is normal.
Right.
Because 9 times out of 10, it probably isn't.
Right.
And, you know, people really muster through. And they are sensitive. They think they're sensitive, and they probably are. Maybe they have very sensitive nipples, or, you know, whatever it is. But that's not like it can't. It's just it's hard because when you get to that point, it's difficult to, you know. Then you have to heal your nipples. You know, you have to address whatever was causing the damage to begin with. You know, a lot of times it's something anatomically, or it has to do with baby's oral motor function, right. You know, things that you want to get, like, you want to get ironed out early. yeah, that's another one that comes up a lot.
What, so I had a patient once tell me this. She was told that her nipples were too big to breastfeed her baby. Can a nipple be too big?
So,
these are the things I hear every day, and
the short answer is, oh, it, okay. So I don't think there's a right answer to this. It depends on the nipple size and the baby's mouth. Some babies are very small, and some mothers have very large nipples. Some babies are born early, premature. Some babies were like super tiny, and maybe the mother does have a large nipple, and maybe the baby gags a lot, or they have a sensitive gag reflex, or they have trouble actually like handling the size of the nipple. I mean, it's a thing, but it's not something, one, that it's not really super common, and it's also not something that can't be worked through. Does mm-hmm. that make sense? Like, it's yeah. not, oh, you can't breastfeed because your nipples are too big. No, like, nature didn't make it so, like, you know.
That was what I was like.
But there might have to be some adjustments or tweaks made initially until the baby's mouth grows or baby grows and they don't have trouble handling it. Now, I would be very curious if when I did an oral exam or an assessment on that infant, if they had a sensitive gag reflex or if they were showing other signs of oral motor dysfunction, or there were tethered oral tissues, or there was hypertonia. Very much a possibility, needs to be addressed.
So moving right along to from nipple size to breast size, true or false? I know the answer to this, but maybe our viewers don't, or our listeners don't. Breast size equals milk outflow.
No. Negative, negative,
negative.
Milk, your breast milk supply and the amount of milk that you can make for your baby have absolutely nothing to do with breast size.
I had somebody tell me that.
Some of the smallest breasts make ridiculous amounts of milk. Like, it has nothing to do with breast size. Now, glandular tissue, which is breast tissue, is important to breastfeeding. That doesn't mean that you have a massive amount of glandular tissue if your breasts are large. So there is something called IGT, or insufficient glandular tissue. We see that sometimes when people have PCOS. Sometimes there's other issues that could cause it. Sometimes they just have IGT. And there's not sufficient glandular tissue. There's ways that we assess IGT and determine if somebody has it. But then sometimes they are not able to make a full milk supply. Some moms with IGT do make a full milk supply at some point. Some do not. It has nothing to do with size. Now, storage capacity can be related to breast milk size. So your breasts are larger than mine, you might be able to store more or like go longer. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah,
like,
it does.
Like, my breasts might get way fuller, you know, before yours do because they're smaller. Like, so I might not have as much storage capacity as you do.
Got it.
But there's always milk in your breast. So I think people think like, oh, well, there's no milk in there. They just eat. It doesn't work that way. Your breasts do become engorged sometimes. That does stop after a certain point. And they tend to empty or feel soft like after the baby feeds. But where was I going with this?
But they don't ever empty out. They're
not ever without milk.
Right.
So there's always a reservoir in there. They say babies take like, I think it's like 67% of what's in there and leave 33. Is that the right math? Like somewhere around that. Like there's always like a reserve of milk. Somebody described it to me once in a support group as like a tap. So like it's a faucet and it can always be turned on and off. Like the flow might be greater because there's more in there at times, but you can turn it on and off whenever you want and there's milk in your breast. You will see cluster feeding from babies at different points in time.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't always mean there's a supply issue. Oftentimes it doesn't. Babies cluster feed for a ton of reasons. Growth spurts, teething, GI upset, gas, they're cranky, they're tired, they're comfort. They just want mom. They just want to be held. They just want to be close to your breast. It doesn't mean like there's a supply issue. Also, milk-making hormone, prolactin, it has a circadian rhythm. So it follows your circadian rhythm. So it is, you're making milk overnight. You have the highest amounts of milk earlier in the day, like overnight into the morning. That's where your breasts are like super full usually. And then it dips as, you know, the day goes on. And a lot of times your breasts will become softer or more soft, or it seems like baby's not getting enough, or they just keep nursing around dinner time or the witching hour. Like in the evening, it doesn't mean you don't have milk then. It means that they're nursing more frequently because they're just trying to get some more milk. Like it's just not as robust as it was earlier in the day.
I am so glad you said that, because that is one thing I did learn, or not one thing. I learned a lot of things via this podcast and the nursing class I took. But you know how many times I tell moms that? And they had no idea.
No. And babies, they do that. They get fussy.
I have no idea.
They get fussy at night. They get fussy around dinner and in those evening hours. And as a first-time mom, until I went to a support group, I didn't know this.
Right.
And it was really... it's very upsetting. You think there's no milk, you're trying to pump, not as much is coming out, because you're not going to pump as much in the evening, FYI, as you're going to pump overnight and in their morning hours. Just so you all know that, like you are not going to pump as much. Like it's normal. Maybe you do. Everybody's different. But
I'm just thinking, it was like, that was the time I was allotted, was like 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
It was the worst time to pump. That's what I had.
So people don't understand that. And something else is, you know, babies breastfeed for so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, I listed a bunch, you know, in this previous conversation. They're not just nursing to eat. I think people go into breastfeeding their baby with this assumption, like, I'm just going to feed my baby. I'm just going to put my baby on my boob every 2 or 3 hours. Every 3 hours. Oh, and when they sleep overnight, I won't, you know, it's going to be great. And that's going to be it. I'm just going to feed the baby. It's not just feeding the baby. It is comfort. We are the original pacifiers. They don't want that stupid Banky. They want to pacify on your breast. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult for people to like comprehend that, but also accept that, especially when we live in such a fast-paced modern society that doesn't really allow for it unless you allow for it.
Learn side lying position.
It's a lifesaver.
It is.
It's a lifesaver. It really is. Side lying is very difficult if you're a first-time mom. It can be really hard to wrap your head around. I helped somebody with it recently. It's like, oh my God, no, this is so uncomfortable, it's not working. And then we did it that time and she was like, oh my God, I think I'm going to fall asleep. And I'm like, that's the point of like side lying, is that everybody can like rest and lay down, and there's different ways to do it. But babies want to feed for all different kinds of reasons. And you have to accept that and know that going into breastfeeding. Like it's not mm-hmm. just going to be feeding the baby. I've read this quote in a book.
Feeding your soul.
Oh, it is my favorite quote. Okay, Dr. Sears, for people that are familiar with the popular pediatrician, he wrote a book called, I think it's the Better Baby book. I don't know. I've read a lot of his books, but he's a very famous pediatrician. And I think his wife was a nurse. They had 6 kids. She breastfed them all. Anyway, he wrote something in a book one time that said, breastfeeding isn't just feeding your baby, it's a lifestyle. And the sooner you accept that, the easier it is. And I swear to God, when I read that line, it clicked for me. And I stopped being so frustrated and annoyed. And I stopped being so like, why is she eating all the time? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, why? Like, I had to make a mindset shift. Mm-hmm. And that was, this isn't just about picking up your baby and feeding them.
It's true.
And sometimes it is like that. Sometimes you're at work and you're pumping three times. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, sometimes it is just feeding the baby. But there's going to be times where it's not.
And a lot of those not times are like the time that you, well, the hard times and the time that you wish you had later. Yeah.
And they want to bond, and that's their way of bonding. I mean, they're biologically programmed to come out and crawl to the breast by themselves. Your Montgomery glands on your breast secrete a scent that smells like amniotic fluid, and they're drawn to it. Like, they want to be at your breast, like, all the time.
Babies are incredible.
Skin to skin is so critical. Like, the first hour, the first couple days, the first couple months, like, any way you can get your baby close to you, like baby wearing. I mean, these are all good things to like get things like off on the right track.
People keep saying to me, like, oh my gosh, you have to birth in the summertime. And I'm like, less clothes. Less clothes. Yeah. Way I more skin to skin.
I know. Yeah. It's kind of nice. I mean, the summertime's kind of nice too.
It's nice. I'm fine. Yeah, I mean, I'm good with Eli.
Yeah. I had one in the winter and the summer, and it was fine. Mentally, I feel like the summer is really nice for everybody.
Yeah, especially when you have an older child, because a lot of your togetherness is outside.
The other thing we talked a lot about that is a really good question that comes up all the time is, how often do I need to feed the baby? And I think I've like beat this to a dead horse on this podcast, but I still can't tell you how many times pediatricians will say, every 3 hours, now's good. 2 to 3 hours. Okay, that's what the textbooks say is about average for a baby to get the number of feedings that they need in a day. Maybe your baby is going to eat every 2 to 3 hours once breastfeeding is like situated. There's going to be a lot of times where they don't, where they eat a lot more than that.
Right.
There is nothing that is more true than that, than the first 6 weeks when you are establishing a milk supply.
Mm-hmm.
So I know like everybody wants to sleep, you know, everybody wants sleep. Once baby's up above birth weight, pediatricians are like, yep, let them sleep. And a lot of times if there's not a weaning issue, that's fine. But just know they're probably going to make up for that then. Other times in that, I tell people right. to look at it as a 24-hour stretch. Like, don't focus on, like, you know, how many times baby slept through the night, or timing it every 2 to 3 hours a day, because you have to make sure you're hitting, you know what I mean? Like,
you're going to drive yourself nuts.
Yes. And people do drive themselves nuts, and they track all this stuff and they record it. And there are sometimes it's
necessary. My brother had a spreadsheet.
Yeah. Maybe. And look, sometimes
maybe that works for you, I guess. Yeah. But like,
and sometimes it's necessary. A lot of times the peds will ask for information that unless you've written it, you like are like, what? Like, why are you serious? Not depending on your pediatrician, but sometimes I will ask families to keep a diaper log and a feeding log, because there are feeding issues, you know, for like a 24 to 48 hour period.
Yeah, it makes sense if there is an issue, right? Like, you monitor things, you track things, but if you're just doing it for the sake of doing it, you're gonna drive yourself nuts.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. I laugh because when Bianca was really small and they gave me a hard time, the pediatrician gives a hard time about her weight, and my midwife said that, but they were like, you need to wake her every hour. You know, I was induced. I had Pitocin. It took 5 days for my milk to come in. So I did have to, fed her around the clock for like multiple days because I wanted her weight to come up and I didn't know any other way to do it. And it was just hard. Sometimes when you have a small baby, the pressure with weight is challenging. But I still remember, like, I have gone back and found logs, and I'm like, like burn this. Like there's a spot on her glider that I told the IBCLC that was leading the support group I was at. I'm like, it was a pen. And it was a cream glider and I loved it. And I was tracking her freaking feedings in the middle of the night and I got pen all over the glider. And every time I looked at that spot, I wanted to like stab someone in the eye because the anaconda was like, I'm always going to be reminded of I had like PTSD for the first 2 weeks of her life.
It got to my glider.
Like, I'm so pissed about the damn pen on my recliner. And it's, like, I mean, it's funny. It's not really funny. I feel like the stress that we put parents through sometimes.
So bad. We do it enough to ourselves.
We overcomplicate it. I think we overcomplicate it a lot. And like I said, now, if there's true challenges, like that's not, you know, sometimes it's necessary to look that closely, but it's like, it's, yeah.
Usually it's not.
What else? I feel like we talked about a lot. It's late. I think
that's good.
I know. Yeah.
People, that's all we're getting today. It's been a week. Digest that information like colostrum.
Digest it like colostrum. Let it run through your tract quickly. Let it
run through your tract. Heal all those gut sensations. Thank you, Val.
Thanks. This one was fun.
Yeah. Well, it's always fun talking about stuff you're passionate about.
Yeah, I know. I know. We talk all night about breastfeeding.
I know. Well, we will in a few short weeks here. Oh, what I'm calling you.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. It's
going to be fine. Yeah.
We're not going to have to worry.
Yeah. Yeah. We got it. All right. I will.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. We'll talk to you soon. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more like it, make sure you subscribe to the Empowered Women Pod and rate us 5 stars. Please feel free to also write a review on the podcast. It really does help to spread the Empowered Women message and it moves us up in the podcast rankings. Plus, we love to hear from our listeners. You can follow us on Instagram at Empowered Women Pod, or if you have a question and want to reach out to Val or I, you can email us at empoweredwomenpod@icloud.com.